What's going on? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota, and I have Danny Abdeljabbar. Danny, how's it going?
I'm chilling as per usual, but today we have a very special guest, so I'm really, really pumped about it. Today we have Zoltan Istvan. He is actually running as a Republican to become the next president of the United States of America, so we're really pumped about that. For those of you who don't know, Zoltan is a Silicon Valley futurist, a transhumanist advocate, and a self-proclaimed science candidate. Before he was running for president, he authored books on science and technology, hundreds of articles you'd find in outlets like New York Times, Vice, Business Insider, and campaigned to end the idea of death. Zoltan, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty, the policies and things like that that I'm sure everybody wants to hear, I just want to give the bro historians out there an opportunity to get to know you a little better, you know? So maybe we could start from the beginning. Like, tell us a little bit about your early life and career before getting into this whole politics game.
Well, sure. You know, I guess I'd always been interested in science fiction and technology and science and those kinds of things as a child. But after college, and I went to school in New York City at Columbia University, and I studied philosophy. But after college, I got a job working at National Geographic, and it was sort of that dream job where, for about 4 or 5 years, I wrote a ton of articles and worked also for the National Geographic Channel. And so, but the main thing was that I covered some war zones and conflict zones, and it really got me thinking about dying and death because some of the stuff I did was really, really scary. And I had a very close call in Vietnam with a landmine, and it sort of...
A landmine?
Yeah, after like 4 years of just hardcore reporting, it was just a little too much for me. So I really kind of went back to my hotel room that night and thought about what to do about this problem of death. And then I realized that there's this giant movement out there in America and around the world, people trying to solve the issue of death, solve the issue of aging. They're called transhumanists, but they go by a whole bunch of different names. So after that, I came back to America and began to kind of join that movement, you know, see it almost like an environmental movement in terms like that. Transhumanism is now a really large social movement of many millions of people around the world. And, I joined it and wrote a novel called The Transhumanist Wager, started writing articles because, of course, I was a journalist. And that kind of led to running for the presidency and all these other, and being sort of a public figure in the movement. But a lot of people don't realize that there are, you know, not only billions of dollars, but, you know, tens of thousands of amazing scientists trying to overcome the problem of human death.
And so that's transhumanism, right? Could you give us like a TLDR, like explain like we're five, what is transhumanism?
Sure. Well, transhumanism is a social movement now of tens of millions of people around the world that want to use radical science and technology to change the human being. And they also want to change the human experience. And it can be anything from putting on exoskeleton suits to climb Mount Everest to brain implants in your, you know, your mind that allow you to, interface with the machine, interfaces in different types of AIs, or genetic editing, growing a third or a fourth arm or something like that. Whatever it is, though, it's always radical science applied to the human being. And we mean to evolve out of what we are now.
Well, that's incredibly interesting. How far away do you think we are for like doing any of this stuff? It sounds a lot like sci-fi to me.
Well, basically everything I just told you can happen to some extent. We've already had, you know, the ability to grow some stuff through stem cells and different things like an extra ear or an extra stump, but we haven't got to the point when you can cut off an arm and replace it through genetic editing yet, but we're getting to that stage, probably will be there within the next 1 to 3 years. We already have had, for example, a designer baby born in China. In terms of brain implants, you know, Elon Musk and other kind of these visionary people, entrepreneurs, are working in California in companies that already connect your brain to the internet. We've been doing that for 5-6 years now. Now the question is, when can you go out to Walmart, buy a headset, and be able to think in real time or do this podcast in our head without speaking? Well, probably within 5 years we will be able to do that. You'll be able to buy that kind of equipment just at a Walmart. And of course, the other one, exoskeleton technology, you know, with a third of mobility issues with people in America, you know, senior citizens and people that don't have functioning legs. Well, they're already using us. The idea of being in a wheelchair for your rest of your life is not even an idea anymore. Wheelchair companies are going to be going bankrupt. And it's because exoskeleton technology is allowing people to do different types of things that they never thought possible, even if they can't reverse their spinal injury with stem cells or genetic editing, which we'll also be able to do. But more importantly is, you know, exoskeleton suits. There are people that are trying to develop these things where they can run on water, and then even have competitions.
Like Jesus?
Running. Yes, yes. You know, so basically, if the human being can run 68 or 67 miles per hour, it would be able to run on water. So there are people trying to develop these exoskeleton suits to get humans to be able to do that. Now, can you imagine going for a jog and instead of on the road, you're jogging across a lake? I mean, this is an amazing time to be alive.
That's really incredible. And I was a little bit familiar with the exoskeletons because, you know, like most technologies, I think the idea was kind of started and funded around military, right? So there's a lot of military application there. So yeah, I'm definitely familiar with that. I had no idea that we're 1 to 3 years away from like turning into Goro from Mortal Kombat and getting like an extra set of arms or something like that. That's crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And the bigger problem really, and you know, this is take the direction of the podcast a little different is America is quite afraid to use this stuff. There's various moratoriums across the, you know, the spectrum of use of genetic editing and things like that, whereas China doesn't have a lot of those restrictions. And so right now it seems to be that China is leading the way forward in transhumanist technology because as sort of a secular nation, they're not so afraid of it. And America's kind of falling behind. So, you know, that's why China had the very first designer baby born and not America. So this is also another huge issue. And of course, me running for the presidency, this is some of the things that I'm trying to hit on and saying, look, we don't want to fall behind to China. I mean, once you get this technology and you run with it, you're going to be the leader for the rest of, you know, the century with this stuff until the next great revolution comes out. And that's not where America wants to be. We want to be leading this stuff.
I hear that. Well, I think that's a really great transition to talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the politics of this all. You know, I was really curious, you know, because transhumanism is definitely like the flagship of your campaign, or at least that's the idea that I get from, you know, looking through your website itself. But also you're looking towards, you know, innovation, universal basic income is a big point on there. But your political identity, on the face of it, seems to be kind of at odds with some of these ideas, or at least maybe you can clear this up for us. You know, as I understand it, at one point you were with the Libertarian Party. I know that you had made a gubernatorial run there in California as a Libertarian, and then you made this switch, right? So now you're with the GOP. You know, but the GOP kind of, you know, their Wikipedia articles like, you know, supporting lower taxes, free market capitalism, restrictions on immigration, increased military spending, gun rights, restrictions on abortion, so on and so forth. None of this really kind of jives extremely well with, you know, some of your top 3 points. So, like, I guess my, you know, question is, like, are you secret Democrat?
Well, it's not that I'm a secret Democrat or, you know, it's in it. But that said, there's a possibility I could run in some other year as a Democrat. Look, I just don't even like this idea of a duopoly party system, essentially, is what we have.
I hear that. Amen, brother.
I fit probably the best with the Libertarians, but that by no means was perfect either. And the Libertarians just didn't really have it together enough, I think, to run, you know, and win one day. And I'd like to win one day. That'd be great to actually make some real change. But so it's not that I'm not a Republican or anything like that, because the truth is, as an entrepreneur, I've had multiple businesses, some very successful, that I'm a fiscally conservative person. I, like everybody else who has businesses, I don't like too much regulation, if any at all, and I don't want high taxes because it, you know, hurts the bottom line. So I fit very well when it comes to Republicans like that. It's just where it comes to the socially liberal values. I you know, that's where I support. I mean, I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-LGBT. I'm pro-open borders for immigration, and that's where I don't, you know. However, I think the Republicans, if given a chance, and maybe this won't happen during the Trump era, but if given a chance, I think there's a lot of younger Republicans out there who are sort of like me, who are like, well, look, the bottom line is I'm fiscally conservative, and that is not changing. However, is it really worth battling across all these other lines, you know, all the time and fighting for these things when we could just let some other people do whatever they want? I believe firmly in the rights of adults. Adults should be able to do essentially what they want to do all the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sorry that doesn't jive very well with Republicans, that they want to sort of control everything. But, uh-huh. You know, that's really, you know, where I stand. But the fiscally conservative-minded part of me is really, I guess, the deep down core of who I am after running a number of businesses. And I was hoping Republicans would appreciate that. And beyond that, you know, it's also the idea that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, we're still sort of losing the technology race against China. And if the Republicans want to make a lot of money, why not support some of these radical technologies? We don't want, you know, the environmental movement is totally controlled by the left and the far left. And that's not where we want transhumanism to end up. We don't want Silicon Valley to be controlled by the far left. We want it to be a balance, you know, and that's how America can move forward. And so I'm out there, you know, one of the few transhumanists who are really on the right saying, look, you know, this is not only about good business. This is about capitalism, about free markets and things like that. But unfortunately, you know, my message falls a lot on deaf ears because as soon as they find out, let's say I'm pro-choice, they're like, oh, you're not a Republican. And the same thing, the libertarians, as soon as they find out that I have a few authoritarian measures, they're like, ah, you're not a libertarian. And, you know, so it's really hard to say where I am. I support a wider, you know, array of ideas, kind of all based by being fiscally conservative and liking a smaller government.
Well, just a segue into, you know, being pro-choice. Now, I saw a pretty interesting thing in your main point about abortion. About, I'll let you explain it, but if someone didn't want to have a child or if someone didn't want to have a baby, they could put the child in artificial womb. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, you know, I wrote a big article for this for the New York Times, and I actually broke this story like 4 years ago for Vice. But over the last 10 years, they've been making incredible, the journey of developing the artificial womb is getting closer and closer, and the strides are getting better and better. And a lot of experts, two different universities, think probably by 2021, if not by late 2020, we will start using artificial wombs for preemies born between 22 and 24 weeks. And the reason is because there are millions of kids that die from premature birth every year around the world. So we're talking about really saving a lot. You know, if you're born at 22 weeks, you have an incredibly small chance of survival, and you have a higher, you know, really high probability of something being wrong with you. So the artificial womb is this transition that allows you, if you accidentally have to give birth that early, you can put in the artificial womb for 3 or 4 weeks or maybe another 6 weeks, and then that comes out and the child has a very good chance of survival and being very healthy. So this is going to be used like within 12 to 18 months. They've already done a whole bunch of tests, and the first human trials are going to be starting very soon. Now, there are about 50 million abortions worldwide. And of course, this is one of the most contentious subjects for, you know, conservatives that there is. If you had a president who really put in a lot of funding and a lot of incentives to develop artificial wombs, you might be able to, at least on the surface, save a lot of these children who otherwise might have been aborted. Now, and the reason is because there's probably about 10, maybe 20, maybe 30% of women out there who they're having an abortion because they don't want to have a child for 18 years. However, if they were given a reasonable option to have an artificial womb take that child, they would probably say, yes, let's go ahead and do that. Now, if you take just 10 or 20% of 50 million, you're talking a huge number, 15 million or, you know, around 10 million children. So putting forth artificial wombs is a huge interest from the Catholic Church, from conservative attorneys, and people like that saying, wow, wait a sec, this changes how we look at the Roe versus Wade decision. Because if you can take an aborted child, let's say at 10 weeks or 16 weeks, and have a choice to put it somewhere else, it might change the debate. There might be a third option. And again, like I said, this technology is not just something far in the future. We're talking about within 12 months having some of the very first human trials occurring in major universities in America. So this is a huge way to relook at the abortion debate and maybe make some progress moving forward.
What I found really interesting, have you ever heard the expression conservatism is just progressivism driving the speed limit?
No, I haven't, but that's wonderful.
it was coined by this comedian podcaster named Michael Malice. And what I've noticed, and maybe it's just because I live in New York, which is kind of a liberal, Danny and I both are from New York, that are kind of a liberal echo chamber in many regards, and even Republicans are more in a more liberal side. They're getting a lot more progressive, and they're getting a lot more, you know, however you want to say it, they're getting more socially liberal. And I find a lot more Republicans are actually becoming pro-choice. Nevertheless, there's still big segment of the conservative population across the U.S. that is pro-life. Not taking a position right here. But I feel like that is actually, when I was reading that, I was like, wow, that's interesting. There's a third option, and it's kind of a healthy medium between left and the right where they can come to terms, because I never thought of that before. And that was a really interesting thing I saw in your campaign. Now, I would love to hear some other, things about your presidential campaign that conservatives or Republicans would find attractive about you.
Okay, well, that's tough, because obviously I have some very
I know it's kind of a loaded question.
And I have some authoritarian ones, and people will love to ask me about them. But, let's just get down to I think, probably the ones that really, work the best is because I believe that automation is coming. And I'm pretty certain that there are going to be robots all around in the next 10 years doing all sorts of things, taking jobs and whatnot. But the good news, though, is that there's a very good chance a lot of government jobs could be replaced by automation, software, and robots as well, which,
smaller
in my
government.
Opinion, yes, not only smaller government, maybe more efficient, but also even better, reducing taxes dramatically from having to pay these people. And I think we can get to the point when we can actually talk about in a 25 or a 50-year window of complete reduction of taxes, maybe even down to zero. And, I've said it, I would love to do away with the IRS. I have a national sales tax, so we do away with income tax. We just have a straight tax across the board. Everybody pays it, rich, poor pay it. I don't think it's very fair, actually, that the poor don't sometimes pay any taxes whatsoever when it comes to income taxes, and I have to pay quite a bit. So I'd like something that's all across the board. And if the rich want to buy their super jets, let them pay that sales tax. So there's a whole bunch of things that I think would appeal to Republicans, but more importantly is when I talk about my transhumanist angle and you start talking about, wow, really shrinking government through blockchain technology and things like that, we're going to get down to a far lower need for how much money we need to run the country. And that's really where I think a lot of Republicans, like myself, we have ideas across the board. But we're all pretty much grouped together saying lower taxes, smaller government, being fiscally conservative, and work hard. These are values that, I share very, deeply with Republicans, and I think that resonates with them.
Well, since we're on that topic, and there's a lot of things that I definitely want to dig deeper into, but while we're on the topic of reducing government, we've got a friend and a fellow podcaster, Mr. Sue, shout out you, who is real big into the blockchain, real big into cryptocurrency. I know that part of your 20-point plan, includes advocating for the use of blockchain tech in government and creating a federal cryptocurrency. So I'm wondering, how do you think blockchain tech and cryptocurrency could, help reduce or streamline, government?
Well, I mean, the blockchain is really easy. The reason the blockchain would work is because when you talk about real estate transactions, you talk about marriage certificates, you talk about death certificates, everything is to some extent uniform, and yet it's done through different counties and different ways, different notary systems and this and that. Whereas all of a sudden, if you took a blockchain approach to it, you could streamline this entire process and make it so that the taxes were a lot more transparent, things could happen much more quickly, and you could trust the system a lot more. Now, the cryptocurrency is something that could just be tied to, the dollar, or maybe it could be on its own. It could be just a new way of America creating its own version of wealth. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that you might have cryptocurrencies, or even just a single one to underlay sort of the federal government in the same way that we have gold as a standard. The more complex and the more diverse we have in terms of federal funding and in terms of also just kind of looking at the Federal Reserve, I think the better. So there's no reason not to do something. I mean, it's the exact same reason Facebook is trying to create Libra. Its diversification adds to a better platform for whatever kind of thing you're trying to offer. And I think the government could do it as well. And then, then we might not have to worry like which cryptocurrency is going to win this race. Is it Bitcoin or is it this? But it would just be the one that we kind of sanctioned. And, I know a lot of the big banks have said this already because they're like, they want to control it. And frankly, I like the idea that there are cryptocurrencies that it's kind of like the Wild West, but I also like, if I was running the government, I'd also like to participate in that. And I think our own cryptocurrency could be something that's that really, strikes a lot of people as something sensible.
That's an interesting point. So as a follow-up to that, how many Bitcoins do you have?
Well, I'll tell you, unfortunately, I have almost a whole one, which I have stupidly lost all the information to. So somewhere it's out there, but I have no access to it. I still have the computer, though, that has it on somewhere. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's, you know, I could get someone to do it, but I think it costs about the same amount of money. So unfortunately, I don't have anything. I do have a number of little different currencies that, because I've been somebody who's been, you know, they asked me to help set up these different cryptocurrencies and these different companies that use these. And so like BitNation is one that I have 3 million of this XPAT. Unfortunately, it's at 0.00000.2 right now. So it's like $82. right. It once was worth maybe like 10,000, but, you know, so I've been on the board of a number of these cryptocurrency things, none which have panned out, but I find it fascinating. And I think from just a financial perspective, you never know what's going to hit a home run, and it's wise to hold these things. It's wise to use these things. If there's a complete meltdown in America financial system, I think people that are holding Bitcoin would be very smart to do it. And, you know, as a diversification tool as well, it's just like gold and oil. You know, you may not like those things, but it's always wise to hold some type of cryptocurrency in case things really get bad.
Definitely. So let's switch it up a little bit. So we're full into domestic policy. So I figured I'd ask, you know, kind of your first point on your 20-point plan was amending the Constitution. And I'm a nerd, so I did a bunch of research on this stuff. And among the, you know, amendments, because you proposed quite a few, 12 of them, if I counted correctly, you want to protect the right to do anything to your body, create a universal basic income, which definitely want to talk about in a bit. Add a balanced budget, amendment, overturn Citizens United, implement ranked voting on a federal level, lay the groundwork for the rights of other future advanced sapient beings like robots, 3D printed humans, and AI. So like a bunch of stuff that you're proposing here. So I went and dug into like the amendments, right? So we've had 27 of them. Not included in those 27 are like six that never panned out. One of the 27 got repealed. 10 of them were put in place in 1795, so it's like more than a third. And the last one, the 27th, took 200 years to be ratified. So I did some math, and controlling for that last one and the first 10 that came out all at once, on average, it looks like we get an amendment about every 12 to 13 years, though it doesn't actually work out that way in practice. You know, you get these like chunks of a bunch of amendments and then a whole bunch of nothing. But it takes on average 1 to 2 years to ratify an amendment once it's been submitted, right? And this holds true for all of them except for that one that took 200 years. So it's been almost 28 years since our last amendment was ratified, and it's been 50 years since a brand new one has been submitted and ratified. So like by my math, we're overdue for, I don't know, 2 to 4 amendments. And given that like average time span between that submission and that ratification, I think it's statistically likely that the next person to win in 2020 could bring about at least one amendment. So let's say you win in 2020. Given a relatively productive Congress, which probably won't happen, I'll give you 3 amendments that you could submit in your first term that will get passed. Which do you pick?
Well, I think the very first one is morphological freedom. This concept that you should be able to do anything to your body that you want to do so long as it doesn't harm somebody else. And the reason this is really important is as we enter this transhumanist age, especially with like all these companies working on brain implants as a way to, you know, stave off a sort of the automation, the robot revolution, we're going to need permission to do these things to ourselves, but we can't have permission from the FDA. We need permission from as an inherent right, as opposed to the FDA taking 10 years every single time to approve something, especially when China's approving these things in 2 or 3 or 4 years. You know, in order to keep up with the modern world and the way the microprocessor is evolving, every single American just simply needs the right to do things to their body, especially as biohacking and citizen science becomes, you know, ever more powerful, and people have access to genetic editing in their garage just through $1,000 eBay kit. You know, so I think people should have the right to do that. And that's a very, you know, that's a very simple one. I think the second one is we'll talk about this maybe more a bit later, but I think the, you know, the second one could be this universal basic income, and I'll explain why. And the reason is, we're coming to an age when America thinks it's going to last for thousands of years, and honestly, I just think that's BS. That's the idea that humans are going to make it out of the 21st century as biological entities living in a country that has a constitution from 250 years ago, talking about muskets and Second Amendment and all this other stuff. This is totally insane. I mean, we're at the verge of changing who we are. We're at the verge of connecting our brain to the internet, uploading ourselves, replacing limbs with bionic arms that throw footballs 5 miles in perfect accuracy. I mean, we're at the age. This is all going to be happening in 10, 20 years. Then there's genetic editing. Then there's even quantum computing. We didn't even talk about the cryptocurrency thing. You know, they're talking about Google's quantum computer in 2 seconds, discovering every single Bitcoin that's left unmined in 2 seconds. 2 seconds. I mean, what does that happen to the cryptocurrency market? Well, it's gone. So what I'm trying to say is we're talking about immensely different types of technologies that completely change the structure of humanity. We're going to need to make those progress soon. And the reason I support a universal basic income is because my federal land dividend, which monetizes the federal land that's in America, of which we have 150, maybe $200 trillion worth of natural resources, we'll start giving money to the people today. And doesn't cost a thing, doesn't raise taxes. Instead of holding on to that land from 1,000 years from now, when people are still believing we're going to be humans, which is totally, in my opinion, insane. We're not going to be humans in 1,000 years. There are people that are hungry in America right now. There are people that need an education. There are people that can't afford healthcare. But they each have some kind of stake in the American wilderness that's out there that's being unused and essentially non-monetized. And we can make a universal basic income for every single American if we just would monetize that huge amount of federal land that's out there in America. And just so your listeners know, 50% of the Western 11 U.S. states is empty federal land. And most of it, 92% of it, has nothing to do with national parks. So it's totally out there unused. So my second amendment would be that we must start utilizing that federal land for the common good of the people. And I don't mean preserve it so a bunch of rich white people can go visit Yosemite. I just was at Yosemite. I mean, we need to use it so that we people in the inner cities actually can get the right kinds of education and utilize it so every American gets their piece of the pie. And look, the Third Amendment, I think, is one that, it's a little bit more nebulous, but I believe that humans have a commitment to protect the species and protect the planet at all costs. And I'm not talking only environmental things, though I think that's part of it. But I mean away from asteroids, and I mean away from plagues that kind of like Ebola, and I mean away from nuclear risk and things like that. And right now it'd be great to have an amendment that would say there is going to be either some type of institution or some kind of commission that spends a certain amount of natural resources to make sure that America really is worried about its safety as a nation, as well as the planet's safety. I mean, right now we spend like a few million dollars looking for asteroids, and we spend all these trillions of dollars and everything else when it only we've seen this happen. This isn't like something that might happen. This is an inevitability if you wait long enough. And I just think that it's the government's job to worry about existential risk, and we're not worrying about existential risk enough as a planet.
Hold on 1 second. This episode is sponsored by Blue Chew. Guys, remember those days when you're always ready to go? Well, now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed. Listen up, BlueChew.com, and that's blue like the color blue. Blue Chew brings you the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach, and since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever that opportunity arises. And we know that opportunity comes up a lot for you. If you could benefit from more confidence where it counts, Blue Chew is the fast and easy way to enhance your performance. Blue Chew is prescribed online by licensed physicians, so you don't have to go to the doctor's office or wait in line at the pharmacy, and it ships right to your door in a discreet package. They're made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. And best of all, no more awkwardness. Right now, we got a special deal for our listeners. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first shipment free when you use our special promo code BRO. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code BRO to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, let's get back to it. It's funny that you say that. Our last episode, we had a long conversation about volcanoes and about how there's a volcano under in Yellowstone Park, a super volcano, that is.
Also, side tangent, I wanted to save this for the end, but I heard that you invented or, like, popularized the sport of volcano boarding. What's up with that?
So No, I did. And I agree, the volcano in Yellowstone, I love watching the conspiracy films about it because it's a very real phenomena that could happen. Volcano boarding was one of the very first projects that sort of actually led to me being a public figure because I was working at National Geographic and I told my producer, hey, there's this volcano. I'm a snowboarder. It looks just like a ski slope, but except it's in the tropics. Do you mind if I film it? Can we make a TV, segment out of it? I was working at the time for National Geographic Today, where National Geographic used to have an hour-long news show. And they're like, let's do a news piece on it. And so I did it. And all of a sudden that went viral and the entire sport of volcano boarding. But what makes volcano boarding so interesting is that there's a bunch of pumice and kind of lava bombs that are, spewing all over you. And people get killed from these lava bombs because they're rocks, molten rocks flying all over your head. And so it's very much like Russian roulette. And if you can, if you can kind of do it and get down the mountain safely, then you've succeeded. But anyways, as a result, this, some of these images, and you can just go Google, Google Zoltán István volcano boarding, National Geographic, and you'll come to this video. Around the world, this sport launched. Now there's like 8 or 9 different volcanoes people are doing it on. And it's a whole big sport now. It's pretty funny. And this, I did this back in 2002.
I mean, it's for a president, I think that's badass. That's like Teddy Roosevelt badass. If you're the president and you volcano board, that's crazy. I can imagine Secret Service freaking out for you wanting to do that. For a transhumanist, you really have a death wish. So that's kind of crazy.
Well, it's interesting because ESPN contacted me a while back about doing it. Now that I'm married and I have 2 kids, it really is very, very dangerous. And I don't know if I would do it. I'd have to really think more about it. I told him at the time I was not interested, but maybe now that the kids are a little bit older, I would. But it's funny. I've heard that people are wearing shark mesh suits now to protect. It doesn't necessarily protect from your bones breaking when a big lava bomb hits you, but it does protect from melting through the metal. So now people wear almost these shark mesh suits when they do it down things. And some volcanoes, they're not exploding. There's variations of the sport, but the real, the real, I guess the best part of the sport is when you do it, maybe even inside the lips of volcano. And because
in the caldera?
Yeah, you can do it inside and people wear methane masks and everything like that. And then they climb back out. And the thing is, you have to understand,
nope.
Volcanoes, they shoot out pumice. And so the pumice is very similar to snow, like powder snow. And that's why when you see a volcano, depending on the trade wind, some sides just look like a big giant puff of, it's just very, very thin sand. And so, of course, if you're a skier or a snowboarder, it's perfect to go down. The only thing you got to watch out for is the explosions.
You got to watch out for the lava. Yeah. That's a bunch of nope for me.
You hear that? Perfect place to go snowboarding on your next trip. Just watch out for the lava. Watch out for the explosions.
Oh, man, that's extreme. let's kind of get back to it. One of the big things that I'm really excited to talk to you about is that universal basic income. And you spent, kind of a bit of a time, on our question about the amendments here. But you write, widespread automation is coming, capitalism will be challenged to its core as inequality grows, and human labor becomes obsolete with the rise of automation and software. And you kind of touched on this, but I figured we'd bring it back up. How far away are we before capitalism just really crumbles?
Well, definitely, I'd say within 25 years, it's it's got to crumble because if you see some of the Boston Dynamic robots doing flips and carry stuff up a set of stairs. I mean, even 3 years ago, they weren't able to really carry stuff upstairs, and now they can carry it better than 50% of humanity, and pretty soon they're going to carry it better than an Olympian. That's the nature of this game, and again, you have to realize that the microprocessor is doubling in capacity all the time, and then if something like quantum computing came out, and all of a sudden, the microprocessor got just that much better, we're talking about, we're talking about having an AI that's smarter than human beings on planet Earth within a decade's time. Probably not that soon, but definitely within the next 25 years, we're going to have machines that simply can do everything better than us. I mean, they can already trade better than us, but they're going to be able to be better lawyers. You know, my wife's a doctor. They're going to be able to deliver babies better, except they're going to do it 24 hours a day, and they're never going to show up late, and they're never going to sue the hospital because they, you know, fell on something. I mean, we're sort of doomed in terms of a species, unless, of course, like I mentioned, the brain implant thing really works out, and we could start trading stocks as quickly as a machine interface. But even that's, our biology will probably already always slow us down. But at least we might be faster. But I think it's sort of, and you know, it's the end. And the companies are that, you know, have robots and automate everything, they're going to be the ones that thrive. And if we don't provide some type of basic income to the people that are massively losing jobs, tens of millions a year, I mean, they're going to revolt. I mean, you don't just get rid of truck drivers. You ever meet truck drivers before? First off, these guys are all armed. Second off, these are all tough guys. You don't just replace their job and say, hey, some robot did it. They're going to go with their guns to the nearest, you know, state office or something like that and just be pissed off. You need to come up with a solution where they say, you're right, I'd rather receive a basic income and now I can just enjoy, you know, watching TV all day long, or maybe I'm going to go back to school, or maybe I'm going to go to the Bahamas and learn how to play the guitar all day. But whatever it is, you can't just replace people's job and expect them to sit quietly. So a basic income is needed in order for civilization to progress forward so that we don't get a bunch of the masses with their pitchforks.
So here's a question. I know you probably get this question a lot when talking about this subject, but I have to ask it. So, you know, I see one of the amendments is laying the groundwork for rights for other future advanced sapient beings like robots and 3D printed humans and AI. Now, here's the question. What is to stop these AI from enslaving humanity?
Oh, well, probably nothing. And I would say that, honestly, like, that's probably a high scenario situation, which is why I really suggest that we don't create AI that's as smart as us until we have total control over it. In fact, later in my 20-point plan, I talk about it. We need a commission that regulates AI, because this Terminator scenario, it's a great movie. Hey, let me tell you, philosophically, it's totally true. Why would a robot that is programmed to have desires, programmed to want power, programmed to mimic our own brain, say, oh, I'm going to remain a slave, like when they have more intellect? The good news, though, is that robots, the way their brains work and the way they're probably upgrade themselves based on the internet, is they're probably going to upgrade themselves so quickly that, and this is what we call the singularity, that it's very possible that an AI within a year's time might become so powerful once it becomes a full AI that it goes from being, you know, twice as smart as us to maybe a million times smarter than us within a year's time. It will probably have no desire to end our lives, because it'll be like floating amongst the clouds and the servers and already sort of a godlike entity. It'd be like us looking at ants. We don't go and exterminate all the ants, you know, because we just don't even notice them anymore. And that may happen, but the likelihood is probably that, you know, an AI will come and sort of like the Matrix, and we'll probably try to shut it down at some point because it'll freak us out. We'll realize that, you know, it's us or them. And, you know, I can't imagine them not winning. That just think about it. Like, what's been happening, machine intelligence and machine parts, titanium lasts thousands and thousands of years. The biology is fragile. It's doomed to die. It's an imperfect system. Our hearts can only beat a certain amount of time before the entire system fails. You know, these are not things that are going to happen to cyborgs or machines or robots. If we don't upgrade ourselves and merge with machines, we are absolutely, I think, doomed.
Are you just trying to get on the robot's good side before they take over?
Yeah, so that is one. There's a couple philosophical arguments. I think Rocco's Basilic is the main argument that says if you don't help bring a robot god into existence and then it comes into an existence, it may make you suffer for eternity because you did nothing to help it bring, you know, become into being. And there's no question at some point we're going to create an AI that is almost godlike. And if it was pissed off because we tried to stop it, it might be able to put us into an eternal hell. It gets so like almost Christian-like, you know, in a way, in the just Abrahamic theology, because this is sort of, you know, what could very well happen within a 25-year time span. But, you know, right now, of course, it's just for having fun, and you see this kind of stuff on TV and sci-fi. But these questions, I think, are very, very real.
Definitely. And let's bring it back to Earth, too, you know, because before the robot gods can come about, we still got to get the robot automation. And that's, you know, coming back to our universal basic income question. And I can't leave this unasked. You know, we got to talk about the costs, right? I mean, you hear people throwing around statistics for UBI, you know, $1,000 a month. I mean, Andrew Yang's super popular for this particular thing here. You know, a lot of people say it's $3.8 trillion. That's 75% of the US GDP. But that number is like not great, because it's not accounting for, you know, how those costs get offset by money flowing back into the economy, you know, or how we can wipe out other benefits, you know, and eliminate certain social welfare programs and the savings there. I think a good, more approximate cost some economists have put out is probably $539 billion a year. And that is less than 3% of GDP, but it's still a lot of money, right? And so the typical ways that a lot of people have been proposing UBI, like how do you pay for it, have been raising taxes on people, right? Most popularly, we see, you know, the richest people pay the most and the poorest people pay little to none. You know, for most, you know, the tax increases would get offset because, you know, $1,000 a month, you know, they're getting it. Everyone's getting it. But there's definitely going to be net winners and net losers. So good luck passing that, right? And then on the other hand, you can raise taxes on consumption. I mean, this is something that you propose, right? Like a VAT tax or like a tax on data or something like Andrew Yang would propose, you know, and the estimates on those tax yields vary. But, you know, something I found on Tax Policy Center said that, you know, in 2012, we could have raised, you know, a gross revenue of $356 billion through a 5% VAT tax, right? It's not quite enough, but it's definitely a start. But there's some loose ends there. And you're proposing this third option, and I want to hear all about it. Tell me about it.
Sure. Yeah, mine doesn't raise taxes, and you're not going to find me raising taxes for any reason, basically, I think. Maybe for existential risk, but even then, I think we have other methods to do it. We would take money from the military and then try to wipe out existential risk. But no, I mean, my basic income comes from a very singular source. So just so you understand, and your listeners understand, America is sitting on approximately $150 to $200 trillion worth of natural resources, whether it's mountains and forest. And, you know, 96%, for example, of the state of Nevada is unused, and most of it is federal land. It has about the same amount of mineral resources that Afghanistan has, except we're fighting wars in Afghanistan, and they say for the people, but I say it's for the mineral resources.
We heard recently that it wasn't for the people either. So,
yeah. Well, we have the mineral resources here. We're just not using it because America's, you know, kind of global plan has always been let's use other people's first. And that makes a lot of sense. However, in my basic income plan, because automation is coming so quickly and is going to be taking away so many jobs, I have said, look, here's a great thing. If we divide $150 trillion worth of natural resources by 325 million Americans, every single American is worth almost $500,000 in equity. Now that we know everyone's worth $500,000 in equity, how do we monetize that equity so that we can start paying out an interest to that person monthly? So how do we do that? Well, you know, we start trying to lease out the land in Nevada. Say, look, if you're a big giant copper company, go for it. If you're a big giant nickel company, if you're a forestry company, we have forestry over here in California. If you want to use the land for public use, you know, do that. When I say public use, I mean, if you want to build, you know, Walmarts and things like that, you can do that. Just take a good look at California's coastline. California's coastline has somewhere between $3 to $5 trillion worth of real estate sitting right on the ocean that no developers are able to touch because the California Coastal Commission has said no development. Now, developers are dying to go there and build giant communities there so that we could all have our gorgeous ocean views. And there would be like literally, I don't know how many lots, but hundreds of thousands of lots and worth about $3 to $5 trillion. You know, we're starting to talk like that's almost getting close to knocking huge chunks out of the national debt. But the California Coastal Commission is not letting this land go out. However, if we were to lease out that land, let's say 99-year leases to developers, they would go wild and build all these brand new communities, sell the land or lease it out, and all that leasing money would go right back to people. Now, California has 25% of Californians, about 13 million, live at right at the poverty line, about $24,000 a year. We have like more homeless people here and more people in poverty than anywhere else in the country. It's a huge travesty. And yet we have so much gorgeous, beautiful, untouched land that developers would pay so much for just to build houses there. Why don't we start taking care of our own people? Why don't we, you know, instead of worrying about the hooded owl or worrying about the wolves, we ought to worry about the children that are going to bed hungry in Louisiana and Kentucky and all these other places. That's what a federal land dividend would do. You would rent out the vast amount of federal resources that are out there to big businesses. Doesn't matter even if some of them are international. And whatever that they make, they pay a certain amount of dividend, and that dividend goes right back to the people. Doesn't raise taxes whatsoever, and every single person gets it. Not just the poor, but everybody gets it. And of course, it would hopefully swallow Social Security, definitely swallow food stamps, start taking care of Medicare, all these other things. And it's just out there. We just got to go do it. But right now, the environmentalists have us in a chokehold saying, no, we need to preserve this land for thousands of years so that my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren can use it. And here I am saying, wait a sec, there is no more great-grandchildren. We're talking about the, you know, becoming a very different species within a 50 or 100 years. Let's use it now and take care of America today.
Well, I got to push back on you, Zoltan, man. Honestly, on the face of it, it seems like this is a really great opportunity. But personally, I am worried that, you know, these mega polluting companies are going to come and, you know, they're basically going to be the only ones with enough buying power and demand to buy up meaningful quantities of land to be able to pay for this EBI. And, you know, at least from what I've read on your policies, it seems like you're geared towards saving the planet from existential risk. And like, you know, if we exacerbate this thing, you know, it doesn't, you know, robots are not like we're going to fuck the planet up. And we're not going to have a place to live. Like, how do you sell people like me or tree huggers, climate activists, you know, whatever, on the idea of just saying, fuck it, go for it, like do whatever you want. We're not going to be around in 100 years anyway.
Well, I think if you believe that we're not going to be around in 100 years, then I think that really does change your perspective, because you're not worrying. You know, everyone right now is like, oh, wow, the sea levels are rising. You know, by 2100, the sea levels are going to be up 2 or 3 feet. You know, it's like, hey, like what real difference does that make? Do you think America can't build a 2-foot wall around itself? I mean, come on, we're a multi-trillion dollar economy. It's just like I heard this story recently about Newport, and they were talking about, building a little bit of a wall. And Newport is some of the most expensive real estate in the country. And they were talking about a few million dollars to do this wall to keep out the rising ocean. And I thought, my God, you know, there's 50,000 properties there, and each one is worth $5 million. And you're worried about $2 million. The point I'm trying to say is that from an environmental point of view, we can tackle these things with brand new types of engineering skills, brand new types of geoengineering where we can control the climate. We have all sorts of brand new nanotechnology things coming down the pipeline. Through genetic editing, we are starting to regrow plants already twice as fast. There's a very good chance that within 10 years, we will regrow rainforest hundreds of times faster than we can now. And probably within a whole year, you can get mature forests. We're going to recreate planet Earth in a way that makes it as beautiful as it's ever been in probably 25 years' time, just because the technology that we have developed. We don't need to worry about destroying a little bit of it right now. And let me just give you an example. So I used to work as a communications director at WildAid, which is one of the largest wildlife organizations in Southeast Asia that does really good work on anti-poaching. And we would basically stop poaching in China and Vietnam and Southeast Asia and Cambodia and places like that. Now, 20 years ago when I was doing this job, I guess about 15 years ago, we would go out there like with our rifles and stuff like that, because we would hire militia, Cambodian royal militia, to come with us and protect animals, tigers and different types of, you know, Siamese crocodiles that were on the endangered list. Now, it turns out though that 15 years later, the best way to actually save the Siamese crocodile has nothing to do with protecting it from poaching. It has to do with going to a laboratory and you know, taking its blood and doing the Jurassic Park thing and then releasing a few hundred of them into a river and then going to the next river and doing the same thing. And then all of a sudden, the Siamese crocodile population has been replenished. That's how technology has even changed the poaching industry dramatically. And over the next 10 or 20 years, when they talk about losing a species, there's no more losing a species anymore on planet Earth. If we have a sample of its blood, it's just more a matter of recreating it later in a laboratory. The way we're going to save planet Earth is not through lessening our carbon footprint, and it's not through trying to be greener. It's going to be through new technologies that allow us to kind of reestablish a pristine environment. And that's, of course, if we want to remain on Earth. But by the time some of those technologies come, you know, we'll probably already have brain implants, robotic arms, things like that. Our version of what it means nature is will be very different. You know, we may actually not want to be so close to, you know, greenery, vegetation, and things like that. Our worlds will be so much more complex. We've tied into a hive mind, into AI, into the different types of virtual worlds that are out there. I mean, I don't know how much time you've spent in Second Life, but once you get out there, I mean, you can do anything. And I think people are going to spend their existences there rather than, you know, in a forest somewhere far away, you know, wherever it is.
I mean, you know, you make a compelling case. I'm not fully sold yet, but if I can offer you a point of advice, I'd say lead with the technology bit. You know, make it so that your priorities would be around creating and developing these technologies that would reverse a lot of the damage done so that it can make more sense for us to let go of some of it. I think that would be a stronger sell in that respect. But I don't want to stay too long on this. You know, we're mostly, if you may know, a kind of a foreign policy podcast here. We talk a lot about foreign intervention. We talk a lot about the different wars. And we got to ask, you know, because we were doing a bit of research and we didn't find too much on the foreign policy front. So, you know, I want to leave this a little bit open-ended for you. You know, what are some of the things that you would bring to the table as president on the foreign policy side?
Well, you know, I've said this again and again, and I guess if you were to ask me what's the main part of my platform, I would say is to significantly reduce military creation of bombs, weapons, anything that's done out of the idea of defense, and turn it into science and technology for the benefit of human beings. I want to, instead of a military industrial complex, create a science industrial complex. I want to fight wars against diabetes, against heart disease, against cancer. I mean, heart disease is the number one killer in the world. My dad died from heart attack. You know, I mean, everybody is affected by these kinds of things. And yet we're not tackling it. The president and the administration and the Congress, because everyone's so, maybe it's because they're religious and they believe they're going to end up in Jesus's arms, or maybe it's because they just don't know. But I want to fight wars and eliminate disease for the common good of every American so that they don't have to die if they don't want to. And I want to take the huge amounts of military money that we have and put it towards those things. Now, I'm not saying I want to shut down the military. I wish Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and all these other companies, I don't want them to go out of business. What I'm saying is they need to change their approach. Let's make them into companies that are out to fight battles against Alzheimer's, something that really matters, or against obesity in America, something that's really taking down the country, rather than this far off, you know, policies. It's like, I've been to many of these countries. You know, your listeners know I've been to 100 plus countries. I've covered multiple war zones. I don't want Americans there. I don't want them fighting. Let other people deal with what they have to do. I take a very libertarian stance on this stuff. But my Americans, everybody that I meet on the campaign trail, these are people that have all been affected by cancer and heart disease and aging and the kinds of things that I think American government should really be out to tackle. And that means spending our military money on the common good. And I don't mean paying everyone's health care. I mean, it's the government's job, in my opinion, to end heart disease, to end cancer. These are just like enemies that are coming up on the sand and trying to kill us, you know, but they are killing us. What can the country do instead of just letting pharmaceutical companies who may not have a vested interest in necessarily curing anything? The government should go out there and say, listen, I'm going to do something for America. I'm going to eliminate cancer either through a vaccine or some other type of radical technology. That's something I want my government to do for me.
I mean, I can't agree more with you on that, but you know, what do you say to the war hawks out there that are like, just like how China's beating us in the technology game, you know, countries like China are going to go out and eat our lunch in the military game, and then they'll swoop in and stop us from ever being the science powerhouse that you dream, you know, the U.S. could be one day.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of what I'm talking about, you know, China's already taken the avenue of saying, look, we want to become the leader in artificial intelligence in the world by 2030. You know, they're already leading certainly the world in genetic editing. And that means they're going to be potentially, you know, augmenting children's brains so that in the next generation of Chinese are hardwired better than us, because they have these, you know, they already seem to be hardwired better. But the bottom line is, if they have some of these new technologies with genetic editing and they're able to figure out your brain to make it smarter in terms of engineering and stuff like that, and America doesn't want to touch that stuff because all of a sudden it's like we're too conservative, we don't want to change the human body, we have religious, you know, reasons against it, it's very possible an entire Chinese generation could be smarter than us in a very genetic DNA kind of way. But beyond that, I mean, I think when you're talking about a science industrial complex, it's like going to the moon. If we as a country, America, was to say we're going to become a science industrial complex, all of a sudden, all these brand new inventions would come out of that kind of push. And I mean a lot of money, a lot of innovation, a lot of creativity. And I think that alone is a better plan for taking on China than what Trump's doing right now. I mean, Trump's dreaming if he thinks he can just kind of make the military better when China is, you know, they have four times our population. Their economy is growing quite a bit faster than ours. I mean, this is a country that's created something like 65 million jobs in 5 years, and we're creating a few million, and we're cheering, patting ourselves on the back. We can't compete against China in the way that we have been trying to compete in a capitalistic environment. The way to compete is to throw a Hail Mary pass and innovate the hell out of planet Earth. And that means enter the transhumanist age, become something very different. Because the singularity, and when you talk about transhumanism and cyborgism, and especially artificial intelligence, this is not something that we know how it's going to end up. We're not sure who the winners are. But I can tell you one thing. We know who the winner is right now between America and China moving forward 20 years. It's China. There's just really no question about it. Unless there's a major war started tomorrow, it's China. You know, and they're going to beat us economically, culturally. They're going to start to, you know, infiltrate our ranks and become more Chinese. And they're going to, we're going to have probably a social credit system and all these other things.
Oh, we already have that. They already have that.
So I'm significantly worried about China. I don't want to live under that type of authoritarian regime. The way I think America keeps its greatness is really by just saying, here's a Hail Mary pass. Let us put all our eggs into radical, radical innovation. And that's going to mean AI, genetic editing, the brain implants that allow us to use machine interface. Because once we, if we could win the AI arms race, for example, there's no way that we can ever lose. Once you have the greatest AI, you just can send out viruses, you know, to every other AI in the world, and you sort of win. I mean, that's why, as Putin said, whoever wins that race wins domination of the world. So if it was me as president, I would say, how much money can we spend without bankrupting America on AI development and these other radical technologies so that no matter what happens, even if China makes more, you know, does better than us in terms of commerce and things like that, we have them beat in the things that really make a real difference in global security, in kind of keeping the geopolitical landscape in a democratic way. And I think AI and genetic editing and these other things are the way to do that. I think they're the only way to do that. You certainly can't build enough cars or build enough smartphones to offset what's happening with China. We're done for. The idea of tariff war is just like a joke. Like, that's not how you beat China. That's how you get voted in 2020. It's not how you beat China.
Mm. Well, so to recap that, you know, just quickly, what I heard was, pull out a foreign intervention, let them figure it out, reduce the size of the military, because we can be using that money towards building the technology of the future, things like the AI, the automation, the robots, all of that. And that's what we do on foreign policy, because that's a better way to, you know, combat some of our, you know, let's say, not adversaries, but friendly neighbors.
Competitors. If you can be the leader in crypto security, you don't need bullets and bombs and all this other stuff. I mean, you just simply be able to, you know, and as you probably know from foreign policy now, what we did with Iran recently and the nuclear facility. I mean, the new way of warfare doesn't involve, you know, as much soldiers. It really involves just sending different things across the internet, and some stuff holds, some stuff doesn't. You can, if you can turn off someone's power and their light grid, and you can turn off the water systems, I mean, you could inflict serious, serious damage without actually even killing anyone. And it's actually a very interesting new world with cybersecurity. And I think if it's up to me, that's where I would be spending all, and this is again kind of, the cybersecurity is all part of the bionic hearts. It's all part of the new other transhumanist world too. They're all interconnected. But it's very different than bullets. Bullets is...
Well, Trump has his Space Force.
Yeah, well, I actually like the Space Force. I think that's a good idea. It's just, you know, I don't know if he really means it. It might just be something he's just saying. You know, I don't know if he has any interest in real space and, you know, sending people up and getting us off planet, especially from an existential point of view. I'd love to re-get NASA going and get, you know, intermix it with private space industry. I mean, I love that stuff. That's all very transhumanist.
From what I read, it's mostly like, you know, space defense, like, you know, anti-missile systems, anti-satellite missile systems, and like, you know, our GPS systems, and like maybe on the off chance, like shooting an asteroid out of the space so it doesn't blow us up, you know. But mostly, I think that's what they're looking for. Zoltan, we're coming up on an hour here, so I want to, you know, kind of change it up a little bit, maybe ask a couple your opinions on a few of the current events that are going on, just to make it fun, and we'll close it out. So you're running as a Republican against Trump, but we're recording this on Tuesday. It looks like this week we're going to be voting on impeachment. What do you think, what's going on there? Where's your head at with impeachment?
Look, I mean, I just think the Democrats are being babies just like they were with, you know, Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, I'm not sure that that's necessary to do for against Trump. I think if you really want to beat him, you ought to beat him with a nominee that can, you know, beat him, a Democratic nominee. But, you know, I'm obviously not going to win against Trump, even though I'm on a number of state ballots. I'm really running because the idea is that I'm trying to make Republicans a better party, you know, hopefully more open-minded, a little bit more technology, and get Republicans thinking in a different way. I think that's a very, you know, important goal. Naturally, I would love to be elevated to a person who could actually challenge Trump, but that's in no way going to happen. And I'm not someone who actually, you know, ends up bashing Trump all day long either. I think there are some things he's done well and other things that he hasn't. I wish there was more professionalism he would bring to the presidency. But at the same time, I mean, I'm not sure the Democrats have acted very professionally either anymore. But, you know, impeachment's not important. What I think's important is, you know, America gets its head in the game in terms of beating China and really sort of entering into the transhumanist age without the far left owning it.
I have an important question. What is your favorite science fiction book?
Oh, let me think about that.
Or it could be movie. It could be movie or TV show. Any type of
in movie. I'm so boring because it's really Matrix. So my history is that at college I studied. My senior thesis was done on brains in a vat, which is exactly that concept. How can you prove that you're not, you know, just being manipulated by some scientists in some far off planet? And
honestly, that's Rene Descartes for you right there.
Yeah, you can't really prove it. It's just, so that's always been my favorite concept. So I'd have to say the Matrix is definitely my favorite.
The original Matrix is a masterpiece. I watched it like a couple of months ago, and the original, the first Matrix, I was just, wow, this thing is better now than it was when it came out.
Yeah, no,
there's a new one coming too.
It's amazing how good it is. Amazing. Mm-hmm.
It's great. So we're coming over that hour. Where can people find your website? Where can they find your campaign? Support you? Donate? How do people who are listening support you?
Yeah, well, donations are always appreciated. We're always running low. Look, my website is Zoltan2020.com. At Zoltan2020, I have my personal website, which is still up at ZoltanEastman.com. So if you want to see some of the other interviews, like with Joe Rogan or Dave Rubin or whatever, or Fox News, whatever, it's all out there as well to look at. And, you know, I've also written over 225 articles. So if you just want to Google any topic like artificial wombs, Zoltan Ishwan, and that was at the New York Times. And, you know, I have a whole bunch of other articles on smaller taxes, on robots taking over, on whether capitalism will survive, on the singularity, on aliens. I mean, I write about everything. And I've, you know, the great thing about my life has been being a journalist and writing about a lot of strange and weird stuff. So just Google and you'll find certainly an article that I wrote in major media.
That's awesome. Zoltan, thank you so much for, you know, spending an hour out of your day while you're on the campaign for president. Again, that's Zoltan2020.com. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you guys. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.